This is a CBC podcast.
Well, hi there. I'm Gian Gomeshi, inviting you to enter the world of arts, cultural affairs, and entertainment with Q's video podcast. Feature interviews with the people and personalities shaping, captivating, and challenging culture. Delivered to your mobile device 3 times a week, visit cbc.ca/Q to subscribe to the Q video podcast and watch what we're doing.
From the Burlington Performing Arts Center in Burlington, Ontario, it's the Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, of all the places you could choose to while away a spring morning, of all the places, high or low, near or far, the bookstores you might dawdle in, the trails you might tramp along, the quiet churches and the lusty boulevards, the libraries and the cafes, of all these places, both here and there, could there be a better place to pass a morning in June than the lilac dell at the Royal Botanical Gardens? The little wooded hollow is only a stone's throw from this theater, but it is a world away from this world. You park your car and head off down the interpretive trail, and if it's your first visit, as it was mine, you will, no doubt, as I did, linger when you come to the first of them. An amateur move, I confess. But then I was an amateur. So I lingered at each little stand of trees and shrubs and read each interpretive sign, learning how early settlers carried lilacs with them in a pot, perhaps, or a careful cutting, wrapped and stowed away. And after they had hacked their farms out of the forest, they planted their lilacs along the fence lines and the hedgerows. So today, if you were to come across a lilac tree in the middle of a forest, in the middle of nowhere, and you were to think to yourself that you have discovered a stand of wild lilacs, more likely you have found an old farm. The poor old farmer long gone, his farm and family overgrown, his lilacs pumping still. Maybe, like I did, you'll meet the gardener on your way along the path, and you will stop and talk. He was installing an 8-foot high plastic deer fence around a tiny little shrub the day I met him. And he was happy to lean on his shovel and engage in small talk. Last year, he told me, the deer ate the leaves off the trees in the dell up as high as they could reach. Never done that before, he said. I could tell by the way he said it that I was supposed to be impressed. And I did my best to look that way. But what I was thinking was, aren't we already in the dell? In rutting season, continued the gardener, nonplussed, they rub up against the big trees. I assumed he was still talking about the deer. And why not, I thought. What better way than lilac soused to attract a mate? But what I was really pondering was, if this wasn't the dell, where the dell might be. And then the little path I was lingering along abruptly ended, and the land fell away, and I was standing on the lip of a valley, and I realized that I had just spent an hour in the theater lobby reading about all the old shows, while the show I had come to see was already underway. First time I went, said my friend Steve, I walked to the edge of the dell and nearly fainted from the fragrance. It wafted up from the valley floor, said my friend Steve, and stopped me dead in my tracks. Stepping into the dell, wrote Rob Howard years ago in Gardening Canada, is like opening your old aunt's closet and smelling all that perfume. I know a woman who grew up here in Burlington who told me that when she was a girl, she'd roll down her car window and stick out her head like a dog and try to smell the lilacs from the highway. And sometimes, she said, I could. And there it is, finally at your feet, a lush green world of white and violet, blue and lilac, pink, magenta, and purple. And yes, there it is too, the intoxicating scent of your old aunt's perfume. The dell is a perfect bowl, and it is lilacs, bushes, trees, and shrubs all the way to the bottom. They say the early morning is the best time to come, when it's quiet and the fragrance is valley trapped by the temperature inversions. But the weekend afternoons, too, when the boys and the girls are embracing on their blankets, and the men my age are pushing their mothers in wheelchairs, holding branches low so they can smell them one more time. They are in bloom for only a few weeks every year. And in this world where we have stepped over the seasons, and the watermelon and the sweet corn and the strawberries that we used to wait for are available all year round, it's good to know of a place that moves to the rhythm of the old clocks. If it is lilacs you want, you have to practice the forgotten skill of patience. You have to drift your way through summer, march your way through fall, huddle your way through winter. Such is the art of delayed pleasure. But suddenly it's spring, and the scent of spring is alive and well and living here in Burlington. The lilac dell is in bloom. Summer is just around the corner. Thank you. Thank you. Well, it's time to get to the music part of the show now, and I am delighted to introduce you to today's musical guests. On bass today, from Grand Falls, Newfoundland, one of the top jazz bass players in the country, he has played with everyone from Rob McConnell to Oliver Jones, the rock steady Jim Vivian. On horns and harmonica from Montreal, Quebec, he has toured or recorded or played with the likes of Vic Damone, Pearl Bailey, Dizzy Gillespie, Quincy Jones, Woody Herman, and Benny Goodman. His CV reads like a history of modern jazz. To that list, you could also add Duke Ellington and Count Basie, Buddy Rich, and Diana Krall. Ladies and gentlemen, Guido Basso. On piano from Powell River, British Columbia, he's worked with George Shearing and Sarah Vaughan, Ed Bickard and Lenny Bro, John Handy and Maynard Ferguson. It's the wonderful Don Thompson. Jim, Guido, and Don are here today to accompany a woman who grew up just around the corner in Hamilton, Ontario. She's been nominated for Hamilton Music Awards, National Jazz Awards, and Juno Awards. She's been called one of Canada's premier vocalists and one of the country's top five female jazz singers. Ladies and gentlemen, would you please welcome Diana Panton.
That old feeling when when you came inside, I got that old feeling. The moment that you danced by, my heart felt a thrill. And when you caught my eye, my heart stood still. And once again I seemed to have that old yearning. And I knew the spark of love was still burning. There'll be no new romance for me. It's foolish to start for that old. Still in my heart.
Diana Panton. And that's off Diana's beautiful album, Yesterday, Perhaps. Well, it's time now for the Vinyl Cafe Story Exchange. Well, you know how this works. This is the part of the show where you send us your stories. They have to be true stories, and they have to be short stories, but after that, they don't have to be anything at all. After that, it's up to you. We promise we'll read everything you send us, and we promise we'll read some of our favorites here on the radio. If we choose to read your story on the radio, we promise we'll send you a copy of our latest Vinyl Cafe book, Revenge of the Vinyl Cafe. A story today from Mary Beth O'Donnell of Charters Settlement, New Brunswick. Dear Stuart, writes Mary Beth, my mother grew up poor on a small farm. They had a cow, a team of workhorses, a handful of chickens, fields and wildflowers. She told us stories of picking small pink wildflowers for the graves of siblings who died in infancy. While she didn't have much at home, she was born with an adventurous spirit. By the time she was 16, the Second World War had begun, and she had begun her teaching career in a one-room schoolhouse. Her siblings were among her first students. After the war, she headed out on her own to Toronto and then Chicago to pursue work as a missionary. Somewhere along the line, she changed her mind and returned to New Brunswick and teaching. Grand Manan, Deer Island, Carroll's Crossing, anywhere there was a job that allowed her to travel, to roam, and to feel free. She married at 33 to my father, a man she had met when she was 21. He had taken her for a ride on the handlebars of his bicycle. When I was born, my parents moved into the house that would become their permanent home. My father, an avid vegetable gardener and lover of trees, began landscaping. He planted trees of all kinds around the yard, sumac, oak, and maple, put the oak in the front yard, and my mother planted tulips around its base. The tulips bloomed a bright yellow that first spring, and they never bloomed again. The oak tree, however, exploded. It took over the front yard. Its branches became a refuge for squirrels and robins' nests. Year after year, the oak tree grew. The tulips would come up each year, but they never bloomed. The four of us also grew, left home, and began families of our own. Retirement allowed my mother's interest and love of flowers to grow, and she planted various flower beds around the house: daisies, brown-eyed Susans, lilies, crocuses, but never tulips again. And then, very suddenly, we realized my mother was ill. Within 3 weeks of recognizing something was wrong, we were gathering for her funeral. It was unreal to us. We were numb. The woman who for so long had given us strength, direction, and the will to move forward was gone. It paralyzed us, all of us, especially my father, her husband of nearly 50 years. It was a difficult winter. But eventually, spring did come. As usual, the tulip leaves under the grand oak came up. But then, to our utter disbelief, they budded, and then they bloomed. Bright, yellow, giant tulips stretching to the sky. 35 years after their first and last bloom, they bloomed again. We have seen 5 springs since my mother's death. Each of those springs, my mother's tulips have bloomed. None of us really understand it, but we've all embraced it. As always, our mom has gone ahead in search of adventure. One day we'll catch up with her again. She's just letting us know she's doing just fine. The story came to us from Mary Beth O'Donnell of Charters Settlement, New Brunswick. This is Diana Penn. Diana Patton, everyone. A soft summer morning, a Sunday in the middle of August. Dave, in jeans and bare feet, is lying on the living room couch, a pile of magazines strewn around and about, a coffee at his elbow, all quiet and gentle, until Morley appears and says, "I think we have mice." You might have thought she had announced the house was on fire. Dave levitated, lifted right off the couch, went from horizontal to vertical so fast and in such a blur that if you'd been there yourself, you would have thought to yourself, did he just go right over the back? Sure seemed like he did. One moment he was lying there as peaceful as could be. The next, he was standing staring at his wife in horror, his agitation positively palpable. I think we have mice, said Morley. No, we don't, said Dave. It felt belligerent. Felt as if he were saying, you are out of your mind. Actually, it was fear. Dave is afraid of mice. Now, you might think that coming from Cape Breton, coming from Big Narrows, which is a pretty small place, more rural than urban, most people heated with wood when Dave was growing up, many still do, so there are wood lots and wood piles and maple bushes and farms and barns and deer in the pastures and bear on the mountain, plenty of rodents and things rodentia. And you might think, having grown up in the middle of all this, Dave would have made an accommodation with mice long ago. But there was an incident. I was 8, said Dave. Actually, he was 12. He was 12 years old, and he woke up in the middle of a dark night. Dark and stormy, said Dave. It was stormy, thunder and lightning. But it wasn't the thunder and lightning that woke him. It was the feeling of something on his face. He was asleep, deep asleep. And he tried to stay asleep. He brushed at the thing on his face the way you might brush at a moth, which is what he thought it was until he realized through the fog of that long ago night that it was a furry rather than a fluttery thing. A mouse, not a moth. And he had a surge of adrenaline unlike any surge he had before and has had since. He snapped awake and there was a swat and a flurry, a fumble of boy and bedclothes, and then there was utter silence. Deep, dark, dead, middle of the alone in the middle of the night. Silence. And he reached out in the still of it, and he turned on the lamp on the table beside him. Somehow, he had moved so fast, so suddenly, so unexpectedly, that he had plucked the thing off his face. And he was sitting there staring at his clenched fist, too afraid to open it. And too afraid not to. He's had nightmares about this for years. Gangs of giant mice corner him in the closet, pick him up and pass him around. But that was later. What happened next that night was he called his parents in a way that caused them to come running. And when they did, they found him sitting in his bed, holding his clenched fist as far away from the rest of him as he possibly could. His mother sat down on the edge of the bed and began to stroke his hair. His father stood by the door. Dave said, I have a mouse in my hand. It was on my face, and now it's in my hand. His mother said, sweetie, you're dreaming. His mother said, open your hand. You'll see. So he opened his hand. See, said Dave, and his mother screamed. And Dave, in his surprise, threw the mouse. And it landed on his mother's head. And she didn't react well. And it's hard to know all these years later whether it was the actual encounter with the mouse or the encounter with his mother that caused Dave's indelible dread of rodents. But now, perhaps, you can be more understanding of why, when Morley came downstairs and said, we have mice, that was terror, not belligerents that responded. Of course, once the idea that they might have mice was introduced, Dave stopped sleeping. And the slow decline into sleep-deprived craziness began. Morley hadn't actually seen any mice, but there was plenty of evidence. Once you started looking, it was everywhere. Dave tried to affect a light-hearted carelessness. "Maybe those aren't mice," he said when she led him into the kitchen and pointed at the counter. "Maybe we have an infestation of poppy seed bagels." But he knew better. He could hear them scurrying around in the walls or ceiling or wherever it was they were scurrying. They made their first sighting a week later, another Sunday, just before supper. They were in the kitchen, Dave sitting at the table going through old mail, Morley standing by the stove. Something gray and peripheral scurried along the baseboards. "Did you see that?" said Dave. "I'm not sure," said Morley. "I am," said Dave, and he stood up and he headed for the car. "No napalm," said Morley. "What about traps?" said Dave. "Humane traps," said Morley. John Wayne once said, "Courage is being scared to death and saddling up anyway." Morley said, "Since when did we start quoting John Wayne?" Dave said, "Since things started getting serious." It was the next night. It was bedtime, or it was bedtime for Morley. Dave wasn't going to bed. Dave was saddling up. Instead of pajamas, Dave had slipped into black jeans and a black t-shirt. He had a flashlight clipped to his belt, and on his forehead, a pair of night vision goggles. "You want to catch a mouse?" said Dave. "The first thing you have to know is where to put your traps." He leaned over and kissed Morley on the forehead. "Go to sleep," he said earnestly. "Be careful," she said. Dave nodded, missing the irony completely. He sat at the kitchen table like a Marine on perimeter duty. He sat and he breathed and nothing else. He knew that if he sat long enough, he would vanish and things would appear. Sure enough, they did. The first came from under the radiator. He didn't spot it right away, of course. It came too quietly. A whisper, a twitch, a suggestion of gray, a shadow of movement. But he sensed it. He saw it a few moments later, scurrying along the wall by the window, little staccato bursts of movement, its tail sticking up in the air, its bulging eyes gleaming black in the green glow of his night goggles. He watched it hugging the baseboard, under the window, behind the fridge, right to the cat bowl. Of course, the cat bowl was so obvious he'd completely missed it. 5 minutes later, it was back again. But now, there were two of them. The one from behind the radiator had been joined by one from behind the stove. The stove and the radiator, and now a third from the pantry, three at once. Two more in the basement, a third in the upstairs bathroom. They were infested. At 4 o'clock, Dave crawled into bed, exhausted and shaken. He set up traps the next morning. He caught three the first night, catch and release. "Where did you release them?" asked Morley. "The Turlingtons," said Dave. Kidding, he took them to the park. But the trick, of course, to getting rid of mice is not getting them out. The trick to getting rid of mice is figuring out where they're getting in. We have to seal up the house, said Dave, who spent the morning crawling around the outside of their house. Where are they getting in, said Sam. Dryer vent, said Dave, they chewed through the mesh. The thing is, a mouse can wiggle through the most unimaginably small space. They can actually collapse their skeletons. Give a mouse a slit the height of a couple of dimes and they don't need more. Dave got a caulking gun and caulked every imaginable crack and crevice. Tight as a drum, said Dave to Sam when he came inside. Of course, you know what that means, said Sam. It means you haven't only sealed them out, Dad, you've sealed them in. It's like a horror movie. We've done this in math, said Sam. This is a progression. You start with one pair, and they have six babies. Assume half of them are female, and assume they each have six babies. There's a formula. Sam ran upstairs and came back with a calculator. He sat down and he punched at it happily. Sam said, roughly speaking, all things being equal, we're talking in 6 months. Sam frowned. Sam said, wait a minute, that can't be right. And he began again. You start with a pair, they have six babies. A minute later, he looked up and he grinned at his father. Roughly speaking, said Sam, in 6 months, we're talking over 10,000 mice. So there they were, early September, 1 month, give or take, into Sam's progression, sealed into their house with who knows how many breeding mice. The mice were getting increasingly bold. They'd begun to see them during the day, something out of the corner of their eyes, after dinner or just before bed, flashes of gray, sometimes real, sometimes imagined. It was impossible to tell the difference. PPMS, Phantom Peripheral Mouse Syndrome. One day, Morley came home and found Dave crossing the kitchen on two kitchen chairs. Moving one and then the other. It had begun to feel as if they were under siege, like the mice were parachuting into their home. Get me my cat, said Dave. Galway was in the living room, curled on the couch. Come on, old girl, said Dave, the game's afoot. Dave carried Galway into the kitchen. You have that cat, do you? He placed her on the floor so her nose was against the baseboard. And he waited. Soon, said Dave. 15 minutes became 20. Come to mama, said Dave. And come it finally did, skittering along the baseboard until it saw the cat and came to a skittering halt, as if it was a cartoon mouse, as if it had just skittered up to the edge of the cliff. It stopped skittering and it stared. Galway lifted her head and stared back, and everything in the kitchen ground to a halt. No one was moving, not Dave, not Morley, not the cat, and certainly not the mouse. Stalemate, whispered Dave. I'm not sure I like this, whispered Morley. And then the mouse ran between the cat and the baseboard, actually brushed her nose, and Galway didn't move a whisker. Did you see his ears, said Morley? Like Prince Charles, said Dave. Suddenly, one of their mice had a name. Prince Charles. It took another week before Dave called for help. And of course, of all the exterminators in all of the world, he got the one who loved mice, Duane, who brought his homemade picture book. and who sat them down at the kitchen table. Duane, in his blue sweater vest, opened his picture book and said, "You need to understand a mouse's life." It was like he'd been sent by the mice. Like he worked for them. "What no one seems to understand," said Duane, "is that you could easily remove some of the big dogs off the top of the food chain, and I'm not suggesting this would be a good thing, but you could let them go extinct, and the world, the natural world, wouldn't notice. The world would continue pretty much as it is." Duane flipped the page of his book, a picture of a polar bear, a picture of a panda, and then he flipped again, and he was holding up a picture of a mouse. A mouse that looked strangely like Prince Charles. "But rodents," said Duane, "you remove all the rodents from the world, and there would be big problems, big, big problems." Duane snapped his fingers. "Things would starve, and I'm talking about things that are more lovable than your mice, things like owls and foxes and other feathered, furry things." Dave persuaded Duane to sell them some poison. "You don't have to put it down," he said as he walked him to the door. "Stockholm syndrome," he said to Morley when he came back. Morley was peering at the box of poison. "Don't worry," said Dave, "it's humane poison, I checked." Slowly, things improved. Slowly, the scurrying diminished, and the nibbling stopped, and one by one, the mice disappeared, until there was only one mouse left, who seemed to have a resilience the others lacked. "Prince Charles," said Morley. Prince Charles, who had read Galway so perfectly that first night, and would now perch on her bowl and help itself to her food while the cat held back and waited her turn. Prince Charles, who seemed to be there to stay. Everybody seemed ready to accommodate the mouse, to accept it as one of the family. It seemed to have earned its place. Dave said, "I'm okay with that." It was just the one, after all. It became clear a few nights later that he was not okay with it at all. They were finishing dinner when he leapt from the table and began swatting his thigh. "Help me," he screamed, "help!" There was a mouse running up his leg. He could feel it under his pants. He was standing there in the middle of the kitchen, tugging at his belt with one hand, squeezing the mouse so hard with the other that he couldn't believe it was still struggling. "Help me," he screamed again. His pants were at his ankles. But now he had the mouse in his fist. Just like when he was a boy. And just like when he was a boy, he threw it, realizing too late what his horrified wife and son had already realized, that it wasn't a mouse, it was his vibrating cell phone. They watched it arc across the kitchen, over the island, over the counter, until it exploded through the window and sailed out into the yard. He put out the traps again that night. He got Prince Charles 2 days later. He'd read somewhere that mice love chocolate. Prince Charles had clearly been able to resist the peanut butter that had been the downfall of so many of his brothers and sisters. So Dave gave chocolate a try. And the next morning, Prince Charles was sitting blissfully in the bottom of the trap, his little whiskers covered in hazelnut caramel truffle. No one else was awake. Dave made coffee while he mulled his next step, put the trap on the table, stared at it. And when Morley came down, she stared at it too. Dave said, "They say drowning is the most humane death." Morley looked horrified. She had been thinking they should get a little mouse cage with one of those drinking bottles and a little dish for the cat food. Dave said, "Give your head a shake." And he put the trap in his backpack, intending to bike over to the park where he'd left all the others. But when he got there, all he could think of was, what's his name?
Prince Charles.
Dwayne. Dwayne, said Morley, the exterminator. If mice were nature's pantry, setting Prince Charles free in the park was like opening the pantry door. Dave sat on a bench with a backpack beside him and, not for the first time, wondered about his moral inconsistency. The way he would indulge his cat while he ate a cow, kill mice and coddle a hamster, fret over his kids and not others. The only thing that explained any of it was the most irrational thing in the world, love. Or if you want to slide it down a notch, compassion. And when did he start loving mice? Where did that come from? Well, it came from the law of proximity, of course. We love the things that are closest to us. But if you love the one, must you not love the many? And where would that leave you? What would that mean? Today, it meant that he picked up the backpack and put it on his back, and he went home and he got his car. He stopped at his store and put a sign in the window, "Open at noon," it said. And he drove out toward the airport, to the racetrack, as rural a place as he knew in the city. They still let you wander around the barns. And so he wandered around. Past all the sleek horses, past all the spiffy stalls. He was waiting for a moment when he would be alone. And when that moment finally came, he opened the little trap and gave it a little shake. Prince Charles fell from the cage, landed on the concrete floor, ran around in an almost circle, started toward the door, turned and skittered into a stable and disappeared under the straw. Dave stood there, trap in hand, half expecting Prince Charles to come back and wave or something. But of course, he didn't come back. The law of proximity had come, and now it was gone. The spell was broken. The mouse was in the straw, and Dave was just a guy late for work. He shrugged and he put the cage back in the pack and nodded at a stable boy as he headed out of the barn, back to the car, and to the uncertain world where he lives. Thank you. Thank you very much. And sadly, we've come to the part of the show where it's time to say goodbye. Before we go, I want to thank our special musical guest, Jim Vivian on the bass, Guido Basso on horns, Don Thompson on piano, and of course, Diana Patton. Thanks also to Lucas Simonetto, Bill Herald, Kyle Kutasiewicz, and Sweeney, Sluggo Sweeney, for the technical assistance. David Amer is the founding producer of the Vinyl Cafe. Greg DeClute is the recording engineer celebrating 25 years at CBC today. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Julie Penner is the music producer. Meg Masters is my long-suffering editor. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton. I'm Stuart McLean. We're going to let Diana Patton sing us out. So long for now.
All I want is a room somewhere, far away from the cold night air, with one enormous chair. Oh, wouldn't it be lovely? Lots of chocolates for me to eat, cozy fire making lots of heat, warm face, warm hands, warm feet. Oh, wouldn't it be lovely? Oh, so lovely, sitting absolutely lewdly still. And I would never budge till spring crept over my windowsill. Someone's head resting on my knee, warm and tender as he can be. Who takes good care of me? Oh, wouldn't it be lovely, 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 lovely? Resting on my knee, warm and tender as he can be. Who takes good care of me? Oh, wouldn't it be lovely, 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 lovely?
You've been listening to The Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean. The Vinyl Cafe is heading out on the road in October, making stops in Fredericton, Miramichi, Orono, Portland, St. John, Yarmouth, Truro, Wolfville, Halifax, Charlottetown, and Moncton. Check the website for all the details, vinylcafe.com.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.